Thanks for the introduction. So my name is Elias Thanasopoulos. I am with 4th ICS, which is located in Greece. This paper is a joint work between 4th ICS and Microsoft Research in Cambridge. So this talk is all about XGS, which is a practical framework for defending against cross-site scripting attacks. So given the short description of this talk, the first question coming to someone's mind is, do we need yet another anti-XSS framework? Currently, there are plenty of published papers like BIP, Nonspaces, DSI, and Blueprint, to name a few. So why do we need another more? Well, XGS has been carefully designed to deliver the following features. First, XGS is web developer friendly. Everything is enabled through an Apache module, and the developer does not need to be aware of the existence of the framework. Second, XGS has a very low computational overhead since XGS is based on a fast operation named XOR, which is available as a hardware instruction in most modern computer platforms. Third, XGS can be deployed in a backwards compatible manner since browsers announce the support of the framework to web servers using standard HTTP headers and vice versa. Fourth, XGS does not require any information from the DOM structure of a web page. Recall that modern web browsers nowadays used to not only to render web pages, but to preview documents like PDFs, which can also contain malicious JavaScript. Fifth, XGS can cope with a significant fraction of cross-site scripting attacks as long as they are based on JavaScript code injections. And sixth, and most importantly, XGS can handle a new variant of cross-site scripting, which is presented in this paper for the first time, and we called it a return to JavaScript attacks. So the main contribution of this paper are two: return to JavaScript attacks and XGS, the framework. So now I'm going to present in more detail the attacks outlined in this paper, which we call return to JavaScript. So this new variant of attack generically applies to frameworks that use JavaScript whitelisting for protecting web applications from code injections. JavaScript whitelisting works as follows. First, you need to identify all JavaScript generated by the web application you want to protect, and mark all this JavaScript as trusted. Or, in other words, put it in a whitelist. Then you should somehow communicate the whitelist to the web browser and force the web browser to execute only whitelisted JavaScript. JavaScript whitelisting was first introduced in BIP a couple of years ago. The main idea behind BIP is the following. For every trusted script, a cryptographic hash, for example, a SHA-1 hash, of the script is kept in a whitelist. So the web browser executes only scripts which their hash is found in the whitelist. In this paper, we argue that whitelisting is vulnerable to return to JavaScript attacks. So let's see what really is a return to JavaScript attack in analogy to the well-known return to libc attack, which occurs in native code. During a return to libc attack, the code injection does not contain code like it happens in traditional buffer overflows. In analogy, during a return to JavaScript attack that targets a web application, the code injection does not contain foreign JavaScript code. Moreover, during a return to libc attack, execution is transferred to another place in the program's code. This place is frequently inside the libc library because libc provides useful functions to exploit the program or to transfer execution and do meaningful things. Similarly, during a return to JavaScript attack, the code injection is based on already existing and whitelisted code. And the injection, instead of putting new code, it alters the web application logic. So let's see an example. Consider the following snippet, which is taken from an imaginary blog application. There is a JavaScript logout function, which we assume because it belongs to the web application code, that it is already whitelisted. This logout function is supposed to be executed when the user clicks on the logout hyperlink. Now, imagine that the blog application is vulnerable and the attacker injects an image tag in a blog comment which executes the JavaScript logout function upon loading. This will cause frustration and annoyance to the user, since the user session will be terminated upon loading a blog story. So the attack here is that logout is already whitelisted, and the attacker is using the logout function, but for a different purpose than the original web developer thought. Let's make it a little bit worse. Imagine a JavaScript delete function which deletes a story when the user clicks in the delete button. Again, assuming that the imaginary blog is vulnerable to script injections, an attacker can place an image tag that calls the already whitelisted delete function upon document loading. This can cause arbitrary data loss. Now, in the worst case, web applications that have rich and full-featured AJAX calls as a user interface can be fully taken over by calling already whitelisted code in various variations in a way that significantly alters the original application logic and behavior. So, now let's see how XGS copes with JavaScript return to JavaScript attacks. So the basic components of the architecture are the following two. XGS is based on two fundamental components, like which are isolation operation or operators and action-based policies. Let's see each of them in more detail. Isolation operators are inspired by instruction set randomization. And they are applied in portions of JavaScript source code, and they assist in isolating the code by transposing it in a new domain defined by the isolation operator. We're going to see an example later. XGS is using as an isolator operator the XOR function, the reason for that is that first, XOR is fast and available as a hardware operation in most modern platforms. And second, because by using XOR, a JavaScript program can be randomized or transposed in a new domain defined by the XOR operation without the need of understanding JavaScript semantics or performing JavaScript parsing. Action-based policies define multiple trust levels by expressing trust policies as browser actions. For example, the web browser, instead of simply executing code, is forced to implement an action-based policy as the following ones. For example, deisolate and execute instead of simply execute, deisolate and execute under user confirmation, or deisolate with the X key and execute. So let's see an XJS session example in order to understand how all these things glue together. In order for the framework to be enabled, we need an Apache running the XJS module and a modified web browser. So first, an XGS-compatible web browser is requesting a document from an XGS-compatible web server, and simultaneously it announces to the server that it supports the framework by including an accept header in the HTTP request. The XGS server, which is equipped with an XGS module, isolates all JavaScript code contained in the document by applying the XOR function with a random key and sends the response back to the web browser by adding an extra HTTP header field which contains the key for the deisolation process. Isolation is achieved by XORing all JavaScript using a random key and by encoding all XOR code in base32 encoding in order to move it in the ASCII pre-double range. This is how actually a page looks. this is actually how a page served by a Next.js web server looks. As you can see, all JavaScript has been crawled, and then we have applied a Base32 encoding in order to make it printable. So, how trusted JavaScript is spotted? We have two assumptions. XJS assumes that all JavaScript contained in files of a web application's distribution is considered trusted. All JavaScript source contained in other sources, like a database, for example, is considered untrusted. Actually, XJS can be modified to support JavaScript templates stored in database as long as the database tables are read-only. So, now I'm going to give a short evaluation of the whole framework, of the whole architecture. The evaluation spans along four axes. We measure attack coverage, server-side computational overhead, client-side computational overhead, and user experience. As far as user experience is concerned, we want to make sure that all transformations that we do in JavaScript that do not affect the user, do not affect the application as seen by user. So, as far as attack coverage is concerned, we collected more than 10,000 web pages from xssed.com, which is a well-known repository hosting real-world cross-site scripting exploits. We identified all still vulnerable web pages with a technique that is outlined in the paper. And I advise you, I encourage you to read the paper for all the technical details of the technique because it's a little bit technical. And after finding out all still vulnerable web pages, we requested all of them, which is about 1,381. Actually, they are actually 1,381 through a custom proxy. All exploits were prevented. And we have a huge analysis for the attack coverage in the paper. So you can refer to the paper for more details. Now, for the computational overhead imposed on the server side, recall that XJS needs a modified web server or a web server that runs an Apache module, our Apache module, and modification to the client. So we need to measure both ends. So as far as computational overhead imposed the server side is concerned, we took three representative benchmarks from the Sun Spider suite. The heavy one, which is composed by many lines of JavaScript code, the medium one, which is a typical JavaScript program, and the light one, which is only a few lines of code. We used AB, the Apache benchmark, to request each of these pages from a web server through a fast Ethernet network. We observed that for the medium and light pages, the computational overhead is negligible. But for the heavy pages, for the heavy page, the overhead is significant, and it's over 60 milliseconds. Fortunately, by repeating the whole experiment through a typical DSL line, we observed that the actual overhead is fixed, and it is less than a typical round trip of time. Thus, the overhead imposed by XJS in the server side does not dominate, since the network delivery overhead dominates the whole transaction. Now, as far as the computational overhead in the browser is concerned, we modified three leading web browsers, namely Mozilla Firefox, WebKit, and Chromium. Keep in mind that we are talking about real modification in the JavaScript engine because we need to make sure that XJS runs before anything else, and we cannot enable XJS through a module in a web browser. So we modified all three browsers, Mozilla Firefox, WebKit, and Chromium. In Firefox, specifically, we modified the built-in JavaScript function eval, and in WebKit and Chromium, we modified the JavaScript engine, which spots and executes scripts. So in Firefox, we have many very short calls, we plot here only 5,000 calls, in reality, if you run this experiment forces all browsers to run the whole SunSpider suite. So, but we plot only the 5,000 first calls of Firefox and all the calls for the other browsers. So in Firefox we have many short calls with less than 1 millisecond of overhead. And the other two browsers, we have fewer but longer calls. But in all cases, the overhead is no more than a few milliseconds per call. Last but not least, we wanted to make sure that the user experience is not altered because of our browser modifications. So, in other words, after the de-isolation process, we want to make sure that all JavaScript is executed correctly without any side effects. So we run the whole SunSpider suite in all three modified browsers and their original counterparts. As was expected, all benchmarks run equally in all modified browsers, equally fast in all modified browsers. So what you need to observe here is that all bars have the same height. I mean, both for the modified browsers and the original ones. So finally, I want to close my talk by presenting two limitations of the framework. First of all, XGS alters the semantics of the JavaScript eval function, which might be not a good idea for a lot of people. More particularly, eval, instead of evaluating code, it is transformed to deisolate and evaluate code. So eval is actually takes the key from the HTTP header and deisolates by XORing the JavaScript instructions and then evaluates them. So explicit calls to eval by the programmer, by the web author, will fail. For this particular issue, the framework provides an xeval function which simply evaluates the context. We know that eval for lots of programmers is considered evil, but unfortunately eval is used in modern web applications. Finally, modern web applications mix heavily server-side code, for example PHP, with JavaScript. In these cases, it's hard for a server-side tool to isolate the complete source corpus of JavaScript contained in a web application in order to apply the isolation process. We are active in this kind of research for trying to find techniques that can isolate in the server-side the client-side part, as is written by the programmer, from the server-side part, as is written also by the programmer, namely PHP from JavaScript. We had recently a paper in Apple Waka workshop, which is co-located with PLDI. And finally, the two takeaways from this talk, in order to conclude, is first, JavaScript whitelisting is not sufficient and it's actually vulnerable to return to JavaScript attacks. And second, XGS is a practical framework based on XOR for isolating legitimate JavaScript and preventing code injections in web applications. Thank you, and I'll be happy to take any questions. We parse all files as long as they do not have heavy intermixing with PHP. all experiments were not done with real web applications like PHPBB, which they have plenty of PHP, they use templates and stuff like that. So the module just parses all HTML code for events and script tags and isolates the JavaScript in this manner. It doesn't do any isolation in databases and doesn't do any isolation in PHP, in JavaScript, which is dynamically generated by PHP, nothing more sophisticated. Okay. Thanks.